10. Of course it's cold. I knew it would be cold. I would have to have known it would be cold. Why wouldn't it be cold in late December? Good God, of course it's cold in Chicago in late December. I'd lived here for 100 years, knew the cold. I'd loved the cold, embraced and mastered the cold, had raced with Pete to the lake when it was frozen, had studied the massive icicles, ice walls, waves frozen in mid-curl. I had objected when clumsy or cruel kids would break the formations, to hear the sound, to see them fall. I had brought my Walkman down, headphones under hat, piously learning the lessons of Echo and the Bunnymen, while throwing rocks across the lake's ice, watching, listening to the beetle-bettle-beetle-bettle of the rocks hopping across the dull smoked glass, extending, the ice but not the rocks, endlessly, indistinguishable from the sky, the horizon vague, like a line, erased or smudged. I knew the snow, the difference between pack and powder, how if you added some water to powder, you could pack it, that if you packed a snowball and ran the hose over it and let it sit for a minute, you'd have not a snowball but an ice ball that, if thrown accurately, all too accurately, would create a massive gash in the cheek of your brother Bill. I knew about the walls of my nose feeling like the hard, frozen walls of a cave in a mountain in the Arctic, toes frozen into pebbles, only dimly related to me, in my shoes, the sting of the wind against my legs, through my papery jeans. I knew all this. So why didn't I bring a fucking coat? Sadder still, I didn't even think about bringing a coat. I did not forget. No. I never thought about it. Not once. I feel the cold when walking off the plane, and worse while thumping through that little hallway between airplane and terminal. Nothing can keep the cold away. I am cold already. I no longer have much use for the cold. Will not be sledding this trip, and it hasn't even snowed. Its only use is as a forced and obvious metaphor, as foreshadowing. But I half wish it were just raining. It is freezing and gray and night in Chicago, and I am wearing a pullover made of cellophane. Toph is in L.A. with Bill, and I am in Chicago. I will rent a car at the airport and will go back to my hometown, and will look up Sarah Mulhern, whose bed I ended up in one night a few weeks after I heard my mother would die, and will visit my father's friends and the bar where my father, on the sly, used to go. And we'll maybe go to his office, and we'll go to the funeral home, and we'll go to my old house, ghosts in pocket, and we'll see my parents' oncologist, and we'll see worried friends, and go to the beach to remember what winter looks like there, and I will look and see if I can find their bodies. No, I won't find their bodies. They were cremated, of course, eventually. But I have long dreamed, because I am misshapen and think it might be an interesting story to tell, of coming closer to finding them. At least seeing the building where they were brought, the medical school. You know what I really want to see? I want to see the face of the doctor or doctoral student or nurse or whoever it was who used my parents as cadavers. I have pictures of them. Not real pictures, but images in my mind of them. In a great armory-sized room, its floor shiny, dotted with stainless steel tables, all with tools, small machines for picking and drilling and extracting, with long, thin cords, and there are medical students, 5 to a table, the table spread out in a way that is perhaps too spread out, not cozy but overly spacious, grid-like, eerie by way of rigidity. God knows what they do with 2 cancer-ridden bodies like that. If they're used as tumor case studies or examined for their parts, like rusted cars on blocks, stripped, their colonized areas ignored in favor of their comparatively benign legs, arms, hands. Oh, God. My dad used to do a trick at Halloween, with a hand. We had a realistic-looking rubber hand, had it for 10 years, it was always around, and at Halloween he would scrunch his own arm into his sleeve, then put the rubber hand where his own hand should be. When a trick-or-treater would come to the door, he would open the child's sack and drop first candy, and then the hand, into the bag. It was great. "Oh my gosh," he would bellow, waving around his handless arm. "Oh my gosh!" The child would be terrified, speechless. Then my dad would compose himself and calmly reach into the bag. "Let me get that." So I plan to find out which medical school received them, and then I will go to the medical school and we'll find the teacher who at the time was in charge of the use of cadavers, and I will knock on his door. I will. I have no courage for such things, but in this case, I will. I will surmount my This is what I will say. Brightly, when he opens the door, the doctor, when he cracks his door to see who is knocked. I don't know what I'll say. Something scary, but I won't be angry about it. I want only to take a look at the man, offer greetings. I want him to be shorter than me, in his late 30s, 40s, 50s, frail, bald, with glasses. He will be dumbstruck by my introduction, afraid for his life, my shadow darkening him, and then I will close in on him, all casual confidence, and will ask something like, "So tell me, what did it look like?" "Excuse me?" he'll say. "Was it like caviar? Was it like a little city with one big gleaming eye, 1,000 little eyes? Or was it empty, like a dried gourd?" See, I have a feeling it might have been like a dried gourd, empty and light, because when I carried her, she was so light, much lighter than I expected. When you're carrying a person, I just thought of this, when you're carrying a person, why is it easier to carry them when they hold tight around your neck? Like, you're supporting their full weight no matter what, correct? But then they grab you around the neck and suddenly it's easier, like they're pulling up on you, but either way you're still carrying them, right? Why should it make a difference that they're holding you to... The point is, at the time, before when I was carrying her, when she was reclining on the couch and watching TV, in general, I was kind of thinking that the thing in her stomach might be terribly heavy. And then I lifted her, and the weird thing was that she was so light. Which would mean that it was something hollow, maybe, not the writhing nest of worms, the churning caviar, but just something dry. Empty. So which was it? Was it the dried gourd or the festering cabal of tiny gleaming pods? Well, I've been wondering for many years. He will tell me, and I will know. And then I will be at peace. Oh, I'm kidding. I kid you. About being at peace? This trip is about the fact that things have been much too calm in San Francisco. I'm making enough money, Toph is doing well at school, and thus... completely intolerable. I will return home and look for ugly things and chaos. I want to be shot at, want to fall into a hole, want to be dragged from my car and beaten. Also, I have a wedding to go to. I stay in Lincoln Park with two grade school friends, Eric and Grant. The night I get in, we go to the place on the corner. Grant is still working at his father's halogen light factory in the shipping department. We talk about when his dad, who we think is perhaps unnecessarily holding him down, will promote him. He is not sure. Eric, our high school valedictorian, is a management consultant. His last assignment involved a month at a pig farm in Kentucky. "What do you know about pig farming?" I ask. "Nothing," he says. He makes gobs of money. He owns the condominium they live in. Grant pays rent for a room in the hideous red brick thing, imposing and square, three stories. I note how ugly their building is. "Yeah," Eric says. "But look at it this way. If you got the ugliest house on the street, you never have to look at it." Eric is good at these sayings. It's unclear where he gets them, but he and Grant now talk like this, full of salty wisdom, the lessons of the plains. Grant, for a long time our only friend whose parents were divorced, has long been sage-like, the old soul among us. His walk was slow. He sighed before he spoke. He grew up in the apartment complex near the high school, and when we drop him off, he'd say, "Roll up the windows, lock the doors. We're entering the ghetto." And this made us laugh. We play pool. After updates on Moody et al., the usual subjects are touched upon. One, Vince Vaughn, we've all known since fifth grade, who everyone from home now watches closely, vicariously, fingers crossed, second-guessing his career choices from afar. "You see him in The Lost World?"
"Yeah, he was okay."
"They didn't give him much to do."
"No."
"He needs another Swingers."
"Right, something ha-ha."
Two, their hair. They both have interesting hair news. Grant continues to lose his, unabated, and Eric has finally abandoned the hairspray he'd been using since high school that made him, though fully coiffed, looked like he was wearing a hairpiece.
"It's nice," I say, looking at it.
"Thanks," he says. "No, really, the way it's kind of feathered like that, all natural, kind of floaty, it's nice."
"Yes, thank you." They're also going to the wedding the next day, the wedding of Marnie's sister, Polly, who is marrying someone we do not know. We have all been invited, about 15 of us, the friends of Polly's sister, and so we're using the wedding as a sort of reunion. Everyone will be there. Most are coming tomorrow, the day after. Grant and Eric are curious why I am here for 5 days, and I tell them enough so that they understand, but not so much that they will worry. We leave the lights off when we get home. They have moved the weight bench to make room for a futon for me. Thanks, I say, getting under the comforter. I'm afraid Grant will tuck me in.
Good to have you, he says, and pats my head.
In the dark, I hear Grant in the next room, his dresser drawer squeaking, and Eric upstairs in the bathroom, water running. I sleep like I have not slept in years. In the morning, I begin. I borrowed a coat from Grant and have brought along a tape recorder, a notebook, and a list of things I want to do while here. The list consists of about 50 items, was typed out and laser printed and then added to on the plane. The list starts with the things mentioned above. Wenban, the funeral home. 924, the street address of my old house. Stuart, my father's friend. Hayde, Dr. Hayde, their oncologist. Sarah, in whose bed I woke up all those years ago. Bar, the bar in the next town. I know where it is, but not its name, which my dad frequented. Beach, a sandy area abutting Lake Michigan, where people gather to meet, sunbathe, play in the water. The list goes on. The idea, I suppose, is the emotional equivalent of a drug binge, the tossing together of as much disparate and presumably incompatible stimuli as possible, in a short span, 5 days, together constituting a sort of socio-familial archaeological bender, to see what comes of it, how much can be dredged up, brought back, remembered, exploited, excused, pitied, made known, made permanent. In the interest of overload, I've continued, on the plane, in bed, to add to the list, tangential or random things, phone calls and unexpected visits to people I haven't seen in 5, 10 years, people I never talked to, wanting to throw anything potentially provocative or brutal into the mess. For instance, handwritten in the margin there is Wooden, a grade school friend who was sent to military school for reasons unexplained to me, but who wrote a very nice condolence note that winter of ours, though we hadn't spoken in easily 7 years. I'm thinking I'll maybe pop by his house, because I never wrote back to him and would like to see what he looks like, how he talks. Maybe say hello to his mother, who one night when I slept over and could not sleep because we had watched Grizzly, sort of like Jaws with fur, had heated milk in a pan for me, had whispered kindnesses in the kitchen. Aunt Jane, who lives in Cape Cod, a phone call? Fox, Jim Fox of Abramson and Fox, my dad's old pinstriped boss, a bent-over and sour man who, as Beth and I were cleaning out our father's desk a few weeks after, came into the office and said this in an unkind way, the way one would talk about a child who was found masturbating too often.
Well, we all knew he was dying.
Donation Place, organization that picks up and then distributes cadavers to medical schools. Medical school, the one most likely to have used the cadavers. The list continues. Other friends, friends of my parents, the few college friends who made it to either funeral, grade school and high school teachers, the park at the end of our street with the tiny frozen lake, Mrs. Ewart, whose lawn I used to cut and whose gardening I used to do, to see if she's still alive, my mother's friends, co-workers, on and on. And, on the side of the page with the list, is this word, written in large letters, crooked though, scrawled left-handed. It stands large, in all caps, next to the computer printout portion in all the handwritten editions. I added it at a payphone at O'Hare, while talking to Toph in L.A., right after my flight landed. The word is... drunk? Which is my question to myself regarding just what state I would best be in while doing this business in and around Chicago. As I was talking to Toph about what he and Bill were doing in L.A., that day they had gone to a batting cage and seen a movie, Bill gets to be the fun one. It occurred to me with great clarity that I should be drunk the entire time. The drunkenness, I guessed, would add to the whole endeavor a haze of mystery, not to mention a romantic fluidity that I could not otherwise count on. I should be desperate, raggedy, semi-coherent, stumbling from place to place. It seemed much more fitting than being calculating and sober, would strip things to their core, would eliminate a layer or two of self-conscious white noise, would allow me to do more asinine things. On the other hand, though, it would be hell on the documentation. Could I really take appropriate notes and make comprehensible recordings while tanked? I get my rental car, and while driving to Lake Forest, I have not yet ruled out the drunk-all-the-time notion, though I've never been intoxicated more than 3 hours in a row without falling asleep, and have rarely been drunk more than once a week. I leave the option open, resolving to decide at the wedding, where I will surely be soused. At that point, I can choose, if the mood seems right, to continue the binge, stock up, have some with me at all times, and a thermos, maybe. The driving, though, the driving would be hard. I head north to Lake Forest, the Highway 41, in late December, and the entire Chicago area looks as mothy and sad as it's supposed to. No snow, just silvery cold and exhaust, black slush. In 20 minutes, I'm outside my old house, and I feel nothing. I'm in Lake Forest on my block, across the street from my house. I'm in the car, listening to a college rock station, and the thing that's occupying me most of all is the state of the neighbor's yard. Something is different. Have they cut down trees? It seems as if they have cut down trees. The car is getting foggy inside, and I am not crying. As I wound up my street, I was sure that I would do something emotional when I saw the house. A part of me hoped briefly that it would not be there, that it had been removed, carried off by a tornado, or that the new owners had raised it, built from scratch. But then, at the bend of the road, it was clear that it was still there, is still here. They have painted blue the wood that we had left gray, but otherwise it looks the same. The shrubs I planted in front to discourage the toddler toff from running into the street are still there, have not grown. I rip a piece of paper from my notebook and write a note. Dear resident of 924 Waveland, I used to live here most of my life. I would love to come inside and look around, but didn't want to arrive unannounced. If you're amenable to the idea, please call me at 312. I'll be here until Saturday. And put it in the mailbox. I do not expect much from it, because in their position, I am not sure I would invite me in. Maybe I would pretend to be on vacation, would lose the letter. I go to the train station in town to use the payphone. It's freezing. I'm looking for Sarah, whose number I don't have. I don't know where she lives. Last I saw her, she lived at home with her parents. Or if she still lives in the area, or in the state. I try a Sarah Mulhern in Chicago. Is this Sarah?
Yes.
Sarah Mulhern?
Yes.
Sarah Mulhern from Lake Forest?
No. Sorry.
I hang up. Blow hot air into my hands. I'm a moron. Someone will see me here, back in town for the first time since I left, using the phone outside the train station. No one uses this phone. Then again, no one will be surprised. They will have expected something like this from me. They know what happened, will assume that I've finally hit bottom, that I'm homeless and on crack. Did I ever belong in this town? Another wrong number, and then... Sarah?
Yes?
Sarah Mulhern?
Yes.
Sarah Mulhern from Lake Forest? A pause, and then, slowly,
yeah?
It has been 4 years, but she's warm. Right away, she's warm. We talk about the last time we saw each other, when we had to sneak out of her house in the morning so she could drive me home, how her dad would have killed me.
He died last year, you know. No, I didn't, actually. I'm so sorry.
Jesus, I'm not sure what to say at that point, but soon enough, I ask if she's going to Polly's wedding. They were in the same class. She is not. I ask her if she has time for lunch, coffee, in the next couple days. She says, any night is fine. The wedding is wonderfully normal. I'd wanted desperately to be at an unsurprising wedding, as rigid and traditional as possible. The idea of them frightened me enough to begin with, but deviation from rote made weddings somehow more absurd. I could not shake the memory of Beth's ceremony 6 months earlier. The groom was a nice young man named James, baby-faced and blonde, and the whole affair took place on a deck in a cluster of cottages near Santa Cruz, high above the Pacific. Beth had long dreamed of having the wedding on the beach, to be barefoot, to be in white on the sand, wind-blown, all of us in front of the shushing waves at sunset. But the permit was impossible to get, so she settled for this group of little houses, beach or no, a wonderful setting, all buttery green and white, though Toph and I barely made it. We were already late, had gone to get Toph some pants, and were driving through San Francisco in our little red car, up Franklin's rolling thoroughfare, toward home to get changed. We stopped at a light at the top of the hill. Then a thump, a jump forward, a crash of glass. We had been hit from behind by some kind of truck. Something huge. It was a woman, mid-40s, in a Jeep Grand something. A huge car. In the woman's car was a family. Two teenage daughters, the husband, all tall, well-dressed, normal. They looked down from their truck with mild concern. The sun was right overhead, and I stood under it for a minute, in the road, the shattered glass flickering on the road. Toph and I walked to the sidewalk, and I sat down, dazed. He stood over me. "You okay?" he asked. "Move over. I can't see you in the sun." "That's better. No, I'm fine." "What are we going to do?" "We have to go. We're already late." We had an hour. Our car had been halved. There was no back bumper, no back window. The hatchback's door was twisted, shattered, unhatchable. We exchanged names and information, and the woman offered to call a tow truck, but there was no time, and when I tried it, the car started, so we left. Back home, changed, and then back in the car, back down the hill, onto the highway, the wind screaming through the car's naked frame, south to San Jose, where we picked up Bill at the airport, who thought the car situation very funny, sitting in back, the wind pouring in, even while I feared with all my soul that the gas tank had been damaged, that we were leaking fuel, that the fumes would spark and we would all explode en route, that it was all too fitting. We rolled in, rumbling and pathetic. The grounds were white with fog, the green was gray, the ocean invisible. Toph and I had nothing approximating formal clothing, were wearing wrinkled white shirts and my father's frayed ties. Everyone knew who we were, that we were them. We met the minister, a lesbian agnostic named Reverend Jennifer Lovejoy, with the flowing robe and wild, steely hair. We said hello to our family's representatives, first our cousin Susie, out from rural Massachusetts, who had been shopping in the small beach town earlier and was wearing a thrift store hat she bought, straw, 8 inches tall, with four woven birds perched on it, and then Aunt Connie, my father's sister, a synthesizer-composer, her music is called Sacred Space Music, who had come down from Marin at the last moment, a surprise, though without the talking parrot or cockatoo usually perched on her shoulder. Before long, she had cornered me and John, who showed up just beforehand, had been drinking tall boys on the way, and had for 15 minutes debated with us the likelihood that the government was hiding knowledge of alien visits from the public. She, of course, knew firsthand of the cover-up, having been receiving for some time messages from outer space through her computer. I asked how she knew the messages were from outer space and not from, say, AOL. She looked at me with pity in a way that said, "If you have to ask." Bill and I were supposed to walk down the aisle with Beth to give her away. She had asked, and we had said yes, of course, that it would be nice, an honor. But then, as Bill and I waited outside in the clearing fog, she decided that, come to think of it, she did not want to be given away, did not like the patriarchal implications of the custom, that she would walk down the aisle alone, under her own power. And so Bill and I sat in the front row and waited as Connie complained about the quality of the pre-wedding music, Mark Isham, she guessed, with a sniff. But the music would change soon enough. When Beth and James came walking down the aisle under a sky that had cleared and was now immaculate, the first notes wafted toward us, piped through two speakers on the deck. It was not the wedding march or Paco Bell. It was, I was panicked, scanning the crowd for a reaction because I was almost sure that this song was, oh no, it was unmistakable, this song. This song was Beth by Kiss. Not an instrumental version, the original recording. And she was barefoot. Did she think this was funny? Surely she couldn't. There was a cliff only 30 yards away, and I wondered if I would be noticed, if I could just slip away quietly as they were all watching the entrance and fling myself over. For Polly's wedding, my first since Beth's, I am clinging to the hope for simple, tradition-bound Protestant solidity. It is at a church, First Presbyterian in Lake Forest, which is a good start, and they've asked us to wear tuxes, which is just fine. The reception is at Shore Acres, the country club in the next town where Bill spent a summer waiting tables. A nice place. Completely respectable. At the reception, what everyone wants to talk about is the English teacher's sex change operation. One of the high school teachers and my former, intrepid, spirited, JV soccer coach has announced that after a spring regimen of hormones and a surgical procedure over the summer, he will be returning in the fall as a woman. We cannot believe it's happening. It's the best thing we've had since Mr. T. When the subject is exhausted, there is the inevitable, "How's Tove?" from Megan. "Still limping."
"How old is he now?"
from Kathy.
"I forget."
"Where is he?" from Amy. "Funny you should ask. He's been hitchhiking." Conversation dissolves and we stare at each other. They know I am not them. I am something else. I am deformed, am 100 years old. I will spend the next day looking for the remains of my parents.
"How's that magazine going?"
Barb asks.
"Probably not for long."
"Why?"
I explain, we're all exhausted, tired of having other jobs that will either get some funding soon and move it to New York, or fold. It's the last thing I want to talk about, think about. I don't want to talk about my failures or theirs. Maybe we're all stunted. Is anything happening for any of us? The celebrity of the night is the date of a girl Marnie went to college with. He's the host of a children's television show in Chicago and has just starred, with one line, in Space Jam, not to mention an even larger role in a recent Jack in the Box commercial. He performs for us, jokes, does imitations of other guests. We adore him. Half of us are talking about moving. Flag has already left for New York for grad school, and I'm vaguely thinking about moving too. But what I really want is to just swim around in a warm baby pool of these friends, jump in their dry leaf pile, to rub them all over myself without words and clothes. But we are all sitting, needing to talk, to catch up. There is a band, they are playing 50s hits. There are 3 female singers with bouffants. They are going all out, these people. Older couples start dancing. I do not like the older couples who dominate this wedding of 2 young people. These older couples everywhere, dancing in a jittery way, each either too slow or much, much too fast. Like that one woman in Gold Lame doing some kind of Latin maneuver as the band plays the Beach Boys, like she's trying to crush ants with her high heels. She wears, as they all wear, an expression that says, "Oh yeah," or "All right," or... I want to jump to the plate glass window and into the club's backyard, and then run to the cliff and jump down into Lake Michigan. Or at least go outside and walk around, but it's too cold, and I don't have the shoes. I can go upstairs, I can grab everyone, and we can leave. I want us all to be in one big bed, naked. Maybe not naked. The bride and groom leave, and the old people leave, and the guy who shook my hand in the bathroom, insisted on it as we stood at neighboring urinals, is thrown out for getting into a kind of physical sort of fight with his girlfriend, and then everyone is gone, and we are the last ones, all of us sitting around, the sweat dried on us, debating where to go, someone's house, a bar. It's only midnight, and we end up in Megan's, eating cookies in her kitchen, looking at the pictures on her refrigerator as we had 100 times before, keeping quiet, because her parents were asleep upstairs. We'd all taken spots in the various empty beds, so I wake up in Megan's brother's room. He's at college, and the room is dark, thickly carpeted, full of mahogany furniture and hockey trophies, team pictures, a stick signed by Dennis Savard. I drive Marnie home, then back to work. An hour or so later, I'm walking across the yard of my old house. There's a new mailbox. They fixed that broken post, repainted the front door. Already, I feel bad for these people. These poor people. They made a mistake letting me in. What will happen when this happens? They should not have invited me. I would have understood if they had not invited me, but the father called and said I could come, and here I am. This will be bad. Things will happen. I will slip and tell them things they don't want to hear. No, I will be good. This will be fine. The door opens, and they are all there. Do they always answer the door together? There are 3 young children, all under 7, 2 boys and a girl. The father with a sweater and a mustache. The mother with a bobbed haircut. The children hiding behind them, peeking behind their legs. I shake the man's hand. They let me in their house. It makes no sense for them to let me in their house. The only thing they know about me is that I once lived here. I wonder if they know what happened there. I assume they do. The parents, at least. Not these perfect little children. I will not tell. We walk straight into the kitchen and the light. The place is filled with light. I look around quickly, trying to find the source of all this light. The walls have been repainted, the wood paneling is gone. Other walls are missing. They've knocked down walls. Cabinets are gone or moved and replaced. There's a new window, or the window is bigger. I can't tell. I can't tell what's different. It all looks different. And small. It looks like a house for small people. But these people are regular height. We tour. They have renamed the living room the family room and vice versa. They've removed the wall-to-wall white carpeting, revealing perfect wood floors, and there's new paint everywhere. The ceilings are fixed, and skylights. We talk, and I ask questions about how they did this and did that. I ask technical questions. Is this new molding? Is this drywall? And I quickly become not the former inhabitant of this place, not some masochistic oddity, but a friendly neighbor with an interest in decorating. Upstairs, the bedrooms are cheerful, pinks, light blues for kids' rooms. My room is unrecognizable. The orange forest wallpaper is gone. My drawings are gone. The carpet is gone. The mirrors on the closet, gone. The broken door has been replaced. Everything is so neat, so tidy. The toys bright, rounded. The children's bathroom has special children's fixtures, little blue and red and yellow toothbrushes. The master bedroom, that's where the skylight is. We had never thought of a skylight. Good God, a skylight! It is so bright, this room. And where there was a walk-in closet full of my father's suits, where it smelled so much of him, the leather belts and smoke-drenched suits and shoe polish, there is now a jacuzzi. I asked them how all this... We put a lot of time into this house, the father says. He makes a soft whistling sound, underlining just how much work it had needed. Yeah, I say. We kind of let things slide there for a while. We go back downstairs, the kids following us around. The laundry room has been repainted, the carpet replaced. The bathroom by the garage no longer has the wallpaper with the groovy expressions. Through the small, tall bathroom window, the backyard looks much the same, white with snow, the hill dotted with plastic toys and red sleds. The sky is white. I am at the beach. I'm at the beach because I need a phone and refuse to conduct this business at the train station in the middle of town. I call Eric in Grant's machine to see if the oncologist has called back. He has not. The beach is empty. The cold is savage. Couldn't be above 10 degrees. I walk from the parking lot along the brick sidewalked promenade, inspecting the benches, each paid for and dedicated. I decide that I will buy one of these benches, that I will dedicate a bench to my mother. Maybe one for him. Maybe one for both. It would depend on how much they cost. Most of the bench's inscriptions simply list a name, but on one, near the phone, it reads, "Roses are red, violets are blue. We like the beach, and hope you do too." Good Lord. I can do better than that. I'll get a bench. I'll get Beth and Bill to chip in. Finally, we will do something. We can afford this. We owe this. Which reminds me, I gasp audibly, alone on the beach, that Tove's high school financial aid forms are due the next day. We've applied to 5 or 6 private high schools and now must submit an application for aid to a national processing center. I did not do it before I left, had left it for the plane, and now here I am, at the lake, with 3 hours to make it to the FedEx box. I go to the car and get my backpack, return and lay the application pages out on one of the picnic tables near the guardhouse. As always, I am immediately stumped by the questions. I don't know or quickly forget everything in this arena. Social security numbers, bank account numbers, the amount we have in savings. Beth will know. I use the payphone under the awning of the snack bar, soaked from the icicles melting above it. I wipe away the puddles, the water warmer than expected, and call Beth in San Francisco. Beth knows why I am in Chicago, but does not understand why I'm at the lake in December. I don't know. I am. There's a phone here. It's cold. I have to call you back. Beth, it's freezing. I'm on the phone. Give me the number there. It's like 0 degrees here. It's what? There are no degrees here, Beth. I'll call you back in 10 minutes. I give her the number and lie down on a picnic table. I experiment with staying warm. Is it warmer when sitting still or when moving? I guess I know that it's warmer when moving, but for a minute I entertain the notion that I can lie still and can will my blood to circulate. With my eyes closed, my breath loud, I direct my blood to speed up. Imagine that I am watching it, picturing conveyors and habit trails. I doze for 5-10 minutes, thinking of life on other planets. The phone rings. Beth is annoyed.
Listen, do we have to do this now?
Yes. Why? Because I have to FedEx it today.
Why?
Because they're due tomorrow?
Why didn't you do it before now?
It doesn't matter now.
Listen, I'm still at a payphone, at the beach, by the lake. It's winter, winter is cold. Can we just do this?
Fine. We go over the numbers. Thanks, that's it. Bye. Out of habit, I tend to call Bill shortly after Beth. I call Bill and Toph in L.A. and get his machine. They are no doubt at the beach, a real beach, warm, watching women play volleyball. I ramble into his tape recorder for a while and hang up. Two men jog by wearing Chicago Bear sweatsuits. As they putter by, they watch me because I am sitting on a picnic table with a pen in my mouth, surrounded by papers. I finish filling out the forms and stuff them into my backpack. On the way to the parking lot, past the snack bar, I put my face against the guardhouse window. Inside, just behind the desk of whoever sits behind a desk at a beach, is a picture of maybe 15 lifeguards posed in bathing suits, all in orange, all grinning, all with extremely white teeth, blonde hair, silver-white hair. There are a few I recognize. The picture must be 5-6 years old. And there, in the back row, is Sarah Mohern. She looks much as I remember her. Tan, blue-eyed, sad-eyed, blonde, curvy. I knew she was a lifeguard, but had never seen her guarding here. Had been at the beach hundreds of times, but had never seen her or this picture. And now, it's too weird. I make a note to write that one down. At the car, I drop my backpack inside and walk back and call Beth again.
Listen, I have a question for you.
Yes? You know about those ashes?
What?
You heard me.
Oh, no.
Whose? Both. Either.
What about them?
Well, you never got them back, right?
Right.
And they never called you about them or anything?
Yeah, they did.
What do you mean?
About a year ago, they called.
They did? Who did?
I told you this.
You did not tell me this.
I did. They called, and they had the ashes. Mom's, at least. They've been trying to track us down.
Where?
Chicago, Berkeley, San Francisco, everywhere.
What did you say? Did they send them?
No.
No?
Then where are they?
I said we didn't want them. You didn't.
I did.
What do we want with some stupid ashes? But without consulting me or Bill? You just...
I have to stop asking questions. Every time I ask a question of Beth, of anyone, expecting something benign or even mildly upsetting, the answer is much weirder and more terrible than I could have imagined.
I just what? She's angry now. I'm too weak to do this.
Nothing.
She hangs up.
This is just too... I'd loved how vague it was before. Where are they?
Well, that's a good question.
Where were they buried?
Another interesting question. That was the beauty of my father's way. We knew that he had been diagnosed, but not how sick he was. We knew that he was in the hospital, but not how close he was. It had always felt strangely appropriate, and his departure was made complete, as was hers, by the fact that the ashes never found us in California, that we had moved and moved again and again, dodging, weaving. I assumed the remains had been bungled, that the medical school or whoever had neglected their obligation, that someone had erred, forgotten. But now, knowing that Beth knew and that they're really gone, discarded, that we had a chance, I had actually entertained, however vaguely, the idea that I might actually find them, that at the medical school they might have them stored somewhere in an ash storage area, in some vast warehouse of unclaimed remains. But now to know,
oh, we are monsters.
I stop at a payphone at the 7-Eleven, on the border of our town and the next, now closed. I call Stuart. His wife answers.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Where are you, in San Francisco?
No, actually, I'm in Chicago. Highwood, actually.
Oh, my gosh. Well, then you're right near him. He's actually in the hospital.
Oh, God.
No, it's just an infection. He's fine. His leg, it's a freak thing. It's all swollen. He's just in for a few days.
Well, I was actually hoping to talk to him, or both of you, for a few minutes, but I'll call again when...
No, go visit him. He's at Highland Park Hospital. He'd love it.
I tell her no, I couldn't. It'd be weird.
Don't be silly. Go.
10 minutes later, I'm there, in the parking lot, in the car. From here, I can see my mom's old room, the New Year's birthday room. I get out and walk around the building to the emergency room. The doors whoosh open. I want to be in the emergency room and have something happen. I want to be back the night of the nosebleed. They took her here first, boosted her white count, stopped the flow. The waiting room looks tiny, all peach and pink and mauve, like a Florida condo. I sit on one of the soft, loungy chairs. Nothing happens. Nothing returns. On the TV, the 49ers are playing. The receptionist is watching me. Fuck it. I leave, walk around the building. In the lobby, I get Stewart's room number and call him. He asks me if I am in town, and I say that yes, I am. He says that I should come over sometime, that he's just in the hospital for a few days, but after he gets out, should be out tomorrow, I tell him that I'm already here. In Highland Park? Actually, I'm in the building. In the lobby? Oh. Why? I lie. Well, I'm supposed to see this doctor here at 5:30, the oncologist, and I... Well, it's almost 5:30 now. Oh, well, that's not totally firm. I can see him afterward.
So you want to come up?
Yes.
It's D-34.
I know. He is on the fourth floor. This is the same building that played host to my mother's various stints, the same building where my father died. The same floor. Probably the same floor. The last time I saw my dad, I was with my mom, Beth, Toph. We walked down this hall, pushed open his door, and were assaulted with the smell. Smoke. They were letting him smoke in the hospital. The room was gray, hazy, and he was sitting there on the bed, his legs crossed at the ankles, his hands clasped behind his head. Big smile. He was having the greatest time. I push open the silent, heavy door, and there is Stuart, the only friend I knew my father had. The moment I step in, I want to leave. The room is dark, and his torso is bare. The only light is above his head, a fuzzy, round halo of amber light above his head. Oh, this is weird. He seems much more sick than he was purported to be. Why is his torso bare? Oh, this is weird. Maybe he's dying too, gray hair all over his body. We shake hands. He has grown a beard, gray and neat. I sit down in the dark at the end of the bed by his feet. I mumble for a while. I ask him about his infection. His leg is discolored, inflamed. It's gargantuan. I no longer feel like asking Stuart the questions I had planned to ask him, the ones I was writing down half an hour ago, in the car, in the parking lot, while listening to 80s rock on the radio. I force myself to start, stuttering about why I wanted to look Stuart up, ask a few things. The first words Stuart says are,
"Well, I'm not sure how much I can enlighten you about your dad's soul."
His voice is measured, even. His arms rest on his torso, bathed in the room's ochre light, the room otherwise brown. This would be the way to die. This is drama. This is appropriate. At night, with the lighting just so. My father's way was all wrong. Alone? The middle of the day? He had fallen again, this time in the shower. He called out to Beth. Beth ran to him, dragged him to the bed. Then the ambulance. He was supposed to be in for a week or so, getting his strength up, not unusual. He had been diagnosed only a few months before. A week after he was admitted, the doctor had called, said things were not looking good, that it could be any time. My mother scoffed. She and Beth went in. I sat for a time in the room, in the smoke. "Come back later," he said. "I'm taking a nap." They drove home.
"He's not gonna go today,"
said my mother, amused by the worrying.
"He's not gonna go today or tomorrow or next week. He just went in."
In an hour, he was gone.
"He was the best driver I've ever seen,"
Stuart is saying.
"The way he would insinuate himself, that was his word, insinuate. Watch me insinuate myself into this lane," he would say. "It was incredible. He'd change lanes, drive on the shoulder."
I tell Stuart the story about how, when he got that car, the Nissan 280, the only new car he ever owned, the first thing he did was customize it. He put an ashtray on the side door and cut the shoulder straps on the seat belts. We all knew he was not a fan of the seatbelt law, thought it was a violation of civil rights, patently unconstitutional. But the odd thing was that in addition to cutting off the shoulder strap on the driver's side, he cut the one on the passenger side. The door opens. It's Mrs. Stewart.
Oh, you did come.
I look up and shrug.
I'll leave you alone for a few minutes.
She leaves. The phone rings. Stewart picks it up.
Oh, hi. Can I call you back?
His meal comes. He offers me his cheesecake. No thanks.
Soup?
No thanks. I ask Stewart if he thinks my father felt alone when he died. The phone rings. He stays on longer this time. When he gets off, he does not come back to my question, and I don't ask again. Mrs. Stewart returns, and we all talk for a few minutes. Then I leave. In the parking lot, I talk to the tape recorder for a while, already having forgotten most of what Stewart said. In the morning, Grant and Eric and I eat breakfast at a diner, watching people pass, the jeans and leather jackets of Chicago winters.
So what did you do yesterday?
Grant asks.
Not much,
I say. Went back home, drove around. I remember that I saw his mom. Grant's mom walks miles every day on Western Avenue. I had driven past her.
Did you say hi?
He asks. No, I didn't realize it was her until too late.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
So what are you doing today?
Probably going back up.
What for?
I don't know. Not much. Maybe I'll go to the high school? Grant looks at me for a second. Maybe he knows.
Well, say hi to LFHS.
Mr. Jacobino, the owner of the funeral home, is not in. The man who is in is younger than me and wears glasses behind bright, startled eyes. Chad. I step in, stamping the snow from my feet. I tell him that I'm hoping to get some papers, that I'm collecting things, that my parents had come through this way, that I was looking for any paperwork they might have.
Let me make a call, he says.
He disappears to call Mr. Jacobino at home, leaving me in the coffin display area. There are 11 coffins in the room, each named according to its style and purported quality. The town being what it sometimes is, the coffins are extravagant, each shinier and more elaborate than the other. One is called the Ambassador. Another seems to be made of steel. I write some of the names down in a notebook I will later lose. I will not be buried, I assure myself. I will disappear. Or maybe by the time I die, there will be machines utilizing advanced laser technology and fiber optics that will evaporate people shortly after they pass away without actually burning them. Experts in the operation of the machine will enter shortly after a death, assemble the machine, it'll be highly portable, and with the pull of a few levers, the person will disappear instantaneously. There will be none of this interment, no carrying bodies around, inspecting them, embalming them, dressing them up, buying holes in the ground for them. This building elaborate boxes for them, boxes reinforced, double thick. Or I'll be launched into space. Or by then, people, dead people, will be raised atop mile-high white towers. Why not mile-high white towers, as opposed to six-foot holes? There would be obstacles, surely, for engineers and architects and the problem of space, but space could be set aside. There is Greenland, for instance, vast and white like heaven. See anything you like? Chad asks. He's behind me. I chuckle. Good one. He has a file folder. We sit down at a table, black and glassy, used for the planning of services. This is what we've got, he says. In the folder are pages recording that Wenban Funeral Home received both bodies, had held a service for my father, and had overseen the donations. The forms and records for my father's service are signed by my mother. Those for my mother are signed by my sister. I like these papers. They are proof. The only proof we have. So this is everything? I ask. That's it, Chad says. I ask if he can make copies of the papers. He says he doesn't see why not. He'll go downstairs. It'll just take a sec. The stairs are cut out of the middle of the foyer.
I watch him walk down. On the wall behind me is a display of headstone offerings, sizes, materials, choices in style, of type, and order of information. The options are many. You can have the name first, the dates first, no dates at all, or before the name, a slogan, Beloved, Eternal. I should probably get a stone. A stone would be good. A stone would save me, would salvage all the damage we had already done, all the things we had given up or lost. Chad walks up the stairs. He has a small brown box. He puts the small brown box on the table in front of me. This is weird, he says, but I was just down there by the copier. Just for the heck of it, I looked on the shelves and saw this. The label on the cardboard box, handwritten. Heidi Eggers. You mean this is... Yeah, this must be the cremains. They must have been sent to us at some point. I'm not sure why they hadn't been sent to you. I touch the box. Good God. Chad stands. I'll go back down and make those copies. He leaves again. Fuck. God. Fuck. The box is about a foot long in each direction and is closed with clear packing tape. It's simple, brown, square, as it must have looked when it was mailed. The label indicates it was sent from the Anatomical Gift Association in Chicago. How long has it been here? I can't make out the postmark. I have to call Beth. I will not call Bill. Bill won't want to hear this, but Beth... I won't call Beth either. Beth will be upset. Chad returns with the copies. I thank him and collect the papers, put them into a folder in my backpack, and stand up. I pick up the box, and I have no idea what I thought it would weigh, but it's heavy. 10 pounds or more. I wander outside. The cold is startling. I turn my back to the wind, protecting the box. I walk to the car, sideways, open the passenger door, and put the box in the seat. I walk around the car, tiptoeing on the ice, open the door, and get in. I turn to the box. The box is my mother, only smaller. The box is not my mother. Is the box my mother? No. But then I see her face on the box. My sick head makes me see the face on the box. My sick head wants to make this worse. My head wants this to be scary and unbearable. I try to fight back, to know that this is normal. All this is normal, but I know that I am a monster, that I should not have come here, that because I am looking for bad things, they are being given to me, and I should not have asked for this in the first place, that because I've been asking for this and more, it will get worse and more brutal. My eyes blur, I shake, I want to put the box somewhere else, in the trunk maybe, but know that I can't put the box in the trunk. The box, which is not my mother, cannot go in the trunk because she would be livid if I put her in the trunk. She would fucking kill me. Late that night, I get back to Grant and Eric's, and they are watching a movie where Al Pacino is blind. Al Pacino is angry and talks with an unplaceable accent. He is maybe Canadian? We are all sitting in different parts of the room, Eric in a comfortable chair, Grant in a comfortable chair, me on the couch between. We are watching TV, drinking beer from bottles. We are completely normal. With Grant and Eric in their condo in Lincoln Park in Chicago, we are regular. I am regular. We are kicking back. I can kick back. I am kicking back. I'm trying not to think about the box, about how 40 feet away in my rental car on the floor of the passenger side is the box. I could not bring the box inside, and I have not and will not tell Eric and Grant about the box, and fearing that someone, perhaps one of them, might pass by the car and see the box and know what it is and be horrified and think me a monster, I have covered it with a towel. Al Pacino is wearing an elaborate military uniform and is yelling at a high school-aged guy in a school uniform. I've come to the movie late, so it's unclear why he is yelling at the guy in the uniform. They are in some kind of swank hotel room. Why is he yelling? I ask. Shh, says Grant. Is he blind? Shut up, it's almost over. The phone rings. Eric answers, tosses it in my lap. You. Who? Meredith. It's Meredith, panicky. Is it John?
Yeah,
she says. Is he?
No, he's okay, but he's threatening again. He sounds drunk.
I take the phone upstairs and into the bathroom. Does he have pills? What?
I don't know. I didn't ask. Maybe he'll do his wrists.
Did he say anything like that? No, maybe. I don't know, I can't remember, but you have to call him. I've been on the phone with him for an hour, and I'm losing my fucking mind. He says he tried to call you, but you weren't home. I'm in Chicago. I know that. I called you, stupid.
I called John.
What's the problem?
Nothing.
What do you mean, nothing? Why am I calling you?
I don't know. Why are you calling me?
Meredith said you wanted me to call.
I tried to call you.
I know. I'm in Chicago.
What for?
A wedding.
Get off!
What?
Nothing. I was talking to the cat.
You're talking to the fucking cat? Listen, I don't have time for...
Fine. Sorry, I'm such a bother.
Okay, so what's the problem? What is it? Are you threatening?
Just had a rough couple of days.
Now you sound drunk. At first you didn't sound drunk. Are you drunk or not? Give me some parameters.
No, it's just this medicine.
Wait, what medicine? What does that mean? Did you already take something? What is this? Is this it?
Is what what?
Did you already?
No, Jesus, I'm just sleepy. I had a beer.
You're supposed to be sober. You can't drink on the antidepressant, stupid. You were sober the last time we talked, right? You're supposed to be sober. How long did that last?
It's one beer. Don't sweat it, my man.
I hear Eric and Grant walking up the stairs, going to bed. Under the door, I can see the lights in the apartment go out. Part of me is bracing for the gunshot. John has been planning it all along, is lulling me into thinking things are fine, and any second, he'll do it, to make sure I hear it, to make sure I know it was my fault. I will have a dead friend. Then again, this is kind of lucky. The timing that John would be threatening suicide the same day I have been given the box, during the week when I have been looking for gruesome things. What are the odds? Fantastic. There's a knock on the bathroom door.
Yeah? You okay?
It's Grant.
Yeah, on the phone. All right, son. We'll see you tomorrow. Night.
Who is that?
Grant.
Now, I ran through the crack house again,
he says. What crack house?
The one off San Pablo near Emeryville. I ran through barefoot this time.
He has done this before, has told me about the running through the crack house. He wants me to be impressed. If it is true, which I doubt,
I am impressed.
I can't let him know this.
And why?
I ask. I know why.
I was feeling weird. I wanted to see what would happen.
And?
Nothing. People just looked at me. Someone said, "Fuck, dude." That was it.
Huh. So, what's the issue this time?
I want to know why we have to do this again. I want to know if he's going to make me give him the talk again. I will refuse.
I don't know. I went out and I don't know. When I got home, I just felt all black, tarry. I don't know. That makes no sense, I guess. I just felt like I was under this net or something. I mean, sometimes I get into these holes. Shit, I don't know. I'm just so tired of it. It's so... Fuck, you wouldn't understand.
I wouldn't what?
I just don't...
I can't believe you'd say that.
You know me. I wouldn't understand. Do you know what I've been doing today? Where I've been tonight? Do you know what's on the floor of my car?
I tell him about the funeral home, the box.
Jesus,
he says.
He likes that.
He is suddenly sober-sounding, animated. This is what he wants, I can tell. Already he is sounding more animated, sober. He wants to share stories, wants to be reassured that however sick he feels, and scared, and ashamed of the contents of his head he is, that I am far worse off. As always, I oblige. I tell him about how, after the funeral home, I spent the night driving around the frozen, broken south side of Chicago, looking for something to happen. I was talking into my tape recorder, staring at groups of kids in their huge jackets, wanting again and again to get out, throw myself at them.
Hey guys, what's up?
To maybe get punched or hit over the head with something or chased. That's what I really wanted, maybe, to be chased. But it was so cold. I tell him that whenever I stopped at a light, I expected a car to pull up in the next lane and that, without turning around, I would know. There would be a crash of glass and a pounding deep into my grassy childhood, and I would see my own blood all over the window. Or I would be at the light and someone would Slim Jim the side door. No, not someone. A black man in an army jacket. The man I always picture when imagining being killed in such a way. Always an army jacket. And he would jump in next to me. I'd have to move the box. Where would I put the box? Backseat?
And then he'd make me drive to the lake, out by the aquarium. He'd have me get out and would walk me over to the edge of the parking lot, facing the water. He'd tell me to kneel, and I would. And then, without a word, he would shoot me twice in the back of the head.
That's weird, he says. I always see it in my own house. I'm tied to a chair, and my mouth is taped, and when I see his gun raised toward me, I can't move, scream. All I can do is try to stop the bullet with my eyes. I always have some weird sense that I can maybe stop the bullet with my eyes.
You know what's funny? I say. The thing I was most worried about when I was down there in the South Side, driving around and talking into the tape recorder, I was worried that after I was shot near the lake that the murderer, who really only wanted the car, would for some reason find and play the tape, the one where I'm describing my imagining someone like him killing me and all this stuff about finding the box and that this murderer would think I'm this racist weirdo. Jesus. That's what I was worried about. I was worried about what the guy who killed me would think of me. Then I worried that the cops, who would eventually find the car in Gary or Muncie or wherever, would find my tape recorder and the tape inside and would play the tape, looking for clues or whatever, and they'd be horrified too. Would be horrified and would also laugh, would make copies and give them to friends.
No.
At this point, I'm no longer worried about John's vague threats. I no longer expect the gunshot. It has worked before. Always works. But now he's more worried about me than himself.
So what happens tomorrow?
Tomorrow I see Sarah.
Oh, man. You have to tell me how it goes.
I will. I expected her to meet me on her building's doorstep, in her coat, maybe pulling on her coat, saying, "Hi, how are you?" wearily. But she has come to the door, without a coat, and has let me in. Sarah Mulhern. I've come to pick her up. We are going to dinner. I am inside her home, and she is glowing. We sit on our couch. I move a pillow.
You want a drink?
She asks, getting up.
Sure. A beer?
Yes, thanks. She goes to the kitchen. Her apartment is immaculate. She has the lights turned down. She comes back, puts on an album by a guy we went to high school with. The guy, my older brother's age, plays piano at the Deer Path Inn, the one hotel in town, and has named the album Deer Path. We talk about how the guy should maybe get out of the town for a little while, get some perspective. We talk about her teaching, seventh grade, in a western suburb of Chicago, the career of Vince Vaughn. We go to dinner, drink during dinner, run through my eating habits, haha, and stay late. We talk about the swim team we were both on, how lame I was and how incredible she was, how her name, when it was spoken over the scratchy loudspeaker to the rest of us, meant grace and power, how she never lost a race, how that fueled my long-standing crush, and about the time her little brother caught me in the club's locker room just after I had stepped in someone's feces.
I never heard about that.
He thought it was mine, though. The feces. Yeah, from then on, to him, I was the guy who shat himself at the club, and there was no way to explain it. Telling him that I had walked into the stall and had noticed the excrement all over the floor,
that would have been harder, probably.
Right. I briefly considered telling her about the picture of her I ran into at the beach. I decide against it. It's weird enough as it is. We go to a bar and run into people we know, all of whom are clearly confused by seeing us together. We have never been seen together. Are 2 years apart, and I haven't been back to Chicago for years and years. I see Steve Fox, who I've known since kindergarten, this grown person whose 8-year-old smiling face I have in albums, pictures from Cub Scout birthday parties. We talk for a minute. Where to start? Should we have hugged? Has he gained weight? But Sarah is uncomfortable. In Lincoln Park, there are too many people we know. It's overload. We leave, find a small, ugly bar, drink until we both feel like we can do what we are both expecting to do, and walk back to her apartment. As we are on her couch, she suddenly pushes me up and back, her hands on my chest, arms extended, and she looks at me in a wild-eyed sort of way. Eyes so round-seeming in the dark here, those whites so white. That at first I interpreted as a sign that my superior kissing technique has her overwhelmed. She looks at me for a second.
You look older, she says.
Right away, I think,
symbolism. I look older.
It's also symbolic that, as we sit on the couch, in the dark, the light through her large windows, the weak yellow light from the street lamp, brings her father into her face. I'd only met him a few times and never saw that stronger resemblance, but now her eyes are darker. It occurs to me that her smoking, as she did when we were at the last bar, is also symbolic. That must mean something, that she says I look older, that she looks like her dead father, that she is smoking like my dead father, that we are opening our mouths on each other even though, outside of having lived similar lives, walked the same path from the parking lot to the pool at the Lake Forest Club, swum the same laps at dawn, we barely know each other. All this means something. What does this mean? After a few seconds, we are again fiddling our tongues around in each other's mouths, turning our faces left and right. But why that weird look she was giving me? Every time I open my eyes, her eyes are open. It's unsettling. Maybe she's unsettled. She is. I know why. She knows I have my mother's box in the rental car. That's it. She can tell. She can tell that I've been driving around with it, right there on the passenger seat, sometimes on the floor, next to Burger King bags, apple juice bottles, like we were on some kind of road trip together. And she can tell that last night I was talking to my maybe suicidal friend and that I wondered if I wanted him to do it. And she knows that yesterday I paused when driving by Ricky's family's house. And she knows that not an hour later, while I was at the library in town, I actually ran into Ricky's mom, who I had forgotten worked there. And Ricky's mom had given me a hug, and we talked about Rick, whom he was dating, all that. And I said nothing about anything much, because if I talked too long, she would know too, and would know that I wanted to tell the world about her husband. And she would know, as Sarah no doubt knows, that as I was driving through the cemetery in Lake Forest, one by the beach, all the gravestones with puddles around them, thin puddles frozen, that I was listening to the Danny Bonaducci radio show, The Partridge Family Guy, which was bad enough while driving through a cemetery, but then on the show was a familiar voice, someone talking about sex. Who was that? And it was Sari Locker. Sari Locker was on the Danny Bonaducci show, on the radio, in the cemetery, talking about how you can put condoms on with your mouth. I was so shocked that I stopped the car to indicate my shock, to punctuate it to myself, to anyone who might be watching, even though I wasn't actually so shocked that I needed to stop the car. And Sari said something mean to him, something about his recently canceled TV show, and after she was off the air, he ripped into her, calling her names, and by that time I was on my way to that bar in Highwood, the one my father stopped at on his way home every night. That's why he always came home at 7:20 on the dot, no matter the traffic. Sarah knows that when I was at the bar in the afternoon, freezing out, mothy gray, I sat at the bar and ordered a Sprite, and then sat, having no idea what I was doing there, what I was looking for at the bar that my father went to. Maybe I expected pictures of him somewhere, his name still on the chalkboard by the pool table. I didn't know. Such great handwriting he had. I looked at the pictures of the bowling teams, somehow expecting him to be among the... I mean, of course, he never bowled much. We are still moving our mouths over each other's mouths, and her eyes are probably still open. And when I was sitting there, I wished for a minute that I had a picture of my dad, so I could hand it, like a detective, to the bartender woman, so she could say, "Yep, sure I know him. Came in every night." But instead, I just sat there. There were novelty mugs everywhere. A bumper pool table. What a feeling was playing on the jukebox. It really was. What a feeling. I opened my eyes, and Sarah's are open again. It's like she's holding her breath. But who can blame her? She knows. She can tell. She knows that after the bar, I went to a payphone and called the Anatomical Gift Association and found out where most of the bodies go, to the University of Illinois at Chicago Medical School, and that I drove there to the west side of Chicago, drove around, lost for an hour amid the blight, the blocks crumbling, the acres and acres crushed, as if walked on by giants. She knows that I finally found the school and the building where the head of the anatomy department was and how I parked down the street and had to jump the fence of a construction site to get into the building and how, once in the building, I was afraid that I would be found out, that they would see my eyes and would call security. So I skipped the elevator and went to the stairs, opened the heavy metal door and we moved to her bed and we fumble, undress. The stairwell was about 80 degrees, 90. It was withering. And I had to walk to the 7th floor where the doctor was, the man I was going to confront about taking my parents and doing things with them. Why was the stairwell so hot? I was drenched by the 4th floor. Doctors walked by me, going down as I was going up, and I had to act casual, normal. I was a student. I had to look like a student.
It was like being inside a heating duct, the heat like wind coming from below, and by the time I got to the 7th floor, I felt faint and burst open the door and felt the cool air sing into my lungs.
Sarah is saying no to something I am trying to do. I'm fumbling with something, trying half-heartedly to do something, but feeling so tired, too, my head so heavy.
And when I found the doctor's name on the listing, spelled with those white movable letters on the grooved black board, I walked to the corresponding door and was going to confront this man, at least look into his face, have it do something, tell me something.
I'm falling asleep, so exhausted, so I pull Sarah's back to my front and fall asleep.
And then open the doctor's door. There was someone right there, a middle-aged man, right there, a man at a desk, only inches from my face, and it was the moment that I could finally... Oop, sorry, I said, and closed the door. Then I took the elevator down, tapping the walls on the way down, leaning toward the doors, vibrating, jumped out, and then down the steps from the building, back through the construction site, walking quickly, jogging a little, then back to the car, in the car, with the radio turned up, back onto the highway, then back to Grant and Eric's, where they were watching cable, and I told them nothing. In the morning, I sleep to 9, 10, 10:30, and don't wake up until Sarah begins to pointedly make noise around the apartment. The room is all white light, the bed so warm still. I have nowhere to be. I want to never leave. I have no plans. I want to chat. I look at her yearbook from her school. I look at pictures of her and her students. They seem to really love her, and this is so good that we're back here in a different place, but together these years later, and it is perfect because now we are connected again, and this is some sort of bridge that was in disarray but is now rebuilt, redesigned, and new, pristine, wonderful. This is great. We'll keep in touch, and when I'm in town, we'll get together, and when she's in San Francisco, maybe we should go get some breakfast. Then I'm at the door, and I'm leaving. I do not know why I'm leaving. Something happened. She tells me that she has to go to the school to do some things, or she's meeting a friend for lunch, or her sister, her mother. It's all hazy. I'm putting on my shoes at her door, feeling the winter air coming through the gap, looking up at her as she says something else. Happy New Year, maybe. And then she has the door open, and we hug quickly, and then I'm on the sidewalk, walking back to Grant and Eric's. I make the trip stiff-legged, cold, trying to remember the words she said. I run the last exchange through my head over and over. Was it, well, now that you've gotten what you wanted... Or was it, was that what you wanted? It was something like that. What did it mean? I try to make the words work, to make them sound familiar, have them make sense. Gotten what I wanted? Was that what she said? Sure I had, I thought I had, that we had been reconnected, all this time collapsed. Fuck, I don't even know what I wanted. Everything was tied together again, and now this... I do not understand this. Are we bound or unbound? I have closed the loop, only to have it come undone again. By the time I get to the beach in Lake Forest the next night, it's dark, about 9 or 10 o'clock. I have to leave Chicago the next day. Last night, New Year's Eve, was uneventful, quiet. We had all walked a few blocks to a party thrown by someone from Eric's office, stood and talked to each other, ate their carrots and celery. We left before midnight, and a few minutes later we're back home, eating chocolate chip mini cookies and watching The Nutty Professor. I park facing the water. I get out of the car and put on Grant's coat, put the tape recorder in the jacket pocket. In the other pocket, I have a notebook and pen. I lean through the car's door and get the box from the floor, then close the door and put the box on the hood of the car. I will do it now. This makes sense. This is the right thing. I don't want to see what's inside. I check to make sure no cars are coming down the beach driveway. Of course, I want to see what's inside. I use my car key to cut through the clear packing tape on the top of the box. I am careful not to cut too deeply for fear of puncturing the bag I expect the ashes are within. Even so, I half expect the ash to billow out, it being light, like dust. And so I squint and turn my head so as not to inhale it. I open the box, spreading the flaps like skin. No ash breathes from inside. Inside, there is gold. A golden canister the size and shape of a container one would keep on the kitchen counter, for cookies or sugar. I am overcome with relief. This is better than the cardboard box, more fitting, even if it's only tin.
Then again, there's something about the gold canister, something sinister, evocative of the Ark of the Covenant, in the movie, with the ash within it. All the bad things that happened to the men who tinkered with the Ark, who disturbed its contents. What if... Jesus, I'm no fucking Nazi. But look at what I'm doing, with my tape recorder and notebook and here at the beach, with this box. Calculating, manipulative, cold, exploitive. Fuck it. I open the canister. It comes slowly. There is some kind of suction from within. I remove the top. Inside is a bag of kitty litter, tied at the top. Fuck. Someone switched the ashes with this fucking kitty litter. This is not it. Where is the ash? The ash like dust. This is not ash. I move the box to the hood of the car to see it better. These are little rocks, pebbles, grape nuts in white and black and gray. I open the bag. Dust rises, a small amount, just for a second. The bag exhaling, its breath smelling. I am terrified of smelling its breath, fearing death, some faint trace of her smell. But it smells just like dust, a simple, dusty smell. And then I sense her watching. I do not do this often, do not often have, submit to, visions of her sitting atop some cloud, looking down, family circus-like, robed and beatific and drawn with a dotted line. But at this moment, I see her suddenly, watching me, not from a cloud, but instead just there, or half there, superimposed on the blue-black sky just over me, and she is just shaking her head, disappointed, disgusted. But isn't it her fault? Surely it's her fault. Did her eyes make me this way? The way she watched, stared, approved, and disapproved? Oh, those eyes, slits, lasers, needles of shame, guilt, judgment. Was it a Catholic thing or just a her thing? At the very least, it had something to do with me not masturbating until college. I figured that part out a while ago. With the bag open, the colors and shapes of the pebbles become clearer. They are 6 or 7 different colors, black, white, light gray, dark gray yellow, yellow gray, cream. Different shapes, smaller, bigger, mostly roundish, but some oblong, some longer even, like fangs. Nothing like the light gray fine ash uniformity I expected and wanted. Oh, this is infinitely more gruesome. You can almost differentiate between the pebbles. What is the white? Bone? Are the black pebbles the cancer, or are they the parts that were burned more thoroughly? What do they use anyway? An oven? An oven, right? So it would follow that parts of the oven were hotter than others? The white must be bone, clearly. Wouldn't this all be bone? What else would survive the heat? Nothing. Nothing, unless some parts, this or that organ, were simply burned to a crisp, like coal. Coal is organic matter. The black must be the cancer. Then what is gray? I walk to the water and across the sand, which on this beach, largely man-made, is not really sand at all, but is, I see the correlation now, also like kitty litter, that being, come to think of it, what we called it as teenagers, when our decrepit and eroding natural beach was replaced with a many-million-dollar beachfront, with a promenade and jetties and protective barriers. Kitty litter is what we called the sand. We hated it because after a day of walking on it or playing volleyball, your feet would be wrecked, sanded, raw. I walk across the kitty litter in my shoes, it crunching like gravel, loudly, and then to the jetty, a foot-wide girder of rusted steel, extending out into the lake, 40 feet long, maybe, until it is met by a low makeshift wall of huge white granite rocks, a pile of giant rocks in a half circle forming a wall protecting the beach from waves. I am holding the gold canister in front of me like an offering. I do not know why I am holding it in this way. I jump a few rocks until I am on the outer part of the rock wall, facing out toward the water. It is a wet sort of gray and blue, foggy almost. The sky and the water smudged together no more than 30 feet out, the water murmuring quietly, its depth, even only 50 or so feet out as I am, seeming. I will slip and fall, hit my head, pass out, fall into the quiet lake, and drown. This is the kind of thing that happens. There's no one here. I will not be saved. I will be gone. Then they will find the rental car, and my... At least the tapes will be destroyed, soaked in my jacket, with my notebook. This is stupid. This throwing the cremains into Lake Michigan? Lake Michigan? Ridiculous. Small. Tacky. Why just a lake? A great lake, sure, but I should be at the Atlantic. I should be on Cape Cod. That would be something. I could drive to Cape Cod. I have a car. I could drive to the last house we rented out there. The one with Aunt Ruth, before she died, when I saw her, Ruth, through a crack in the bathroom door without her wig on, her fiery red hair gone. I'd have to call the rental company, confirm that I could rent here, drop it off there. I would drive to the Cape, and then fly back to San Francisco. How long would that take, the drive? We did it dozens of times. Chicago to Cape Cod, we three kids, mom driving 8 hours a day. Fuck, the drive would take at least 2 days. And I have to meet Toaf at the airport tomorrow. He'll be coming up from L.A. We timed it so we'd both be at the airport at the same time. Fuck, I can't do Cape Cod. Maybe if I called Bill. Fuck it, then I'd have to tell him about this, and he'd be disturbed and... Fuck it, it makes sense here. It makes sense to be doing this here, now. It makes sense. It is good. It is the first of the year, after all. Jesus. It's her motherfucking birthday. I cannot believe that this happened again. Why do I not connect these things? Why do I know her birthday is approaching, but do not remember on the actual day? Do not remember until I am on a jetty in the lake with her... That does it. That's a sign. Screw it. That means this is good. No doubt. She loved the beach. Her favorite place. Loved to come and set up her chair near the water, her feet in the water, eyes closed, absorbing the sun, me behind her, in her shade, cool, with my blanket and bottle. I put my hand in the bag and grab a handful. It's so light. I don't know what I expected, but this lightness, I did not. I cannot believe I am holding. I am sick to be holding. I throw. In the air, it spreads out in a wide diagonal and drops into the groaning lake with a series of pit-tits. I throw again. Some spills. I should not spill. It spilled right there by my left foot, about 8 particles. I'm stepping on them. Of course I am. Of course I'm stepping on them. How fitting. How expected, asshole. I lean over to pick up the particles, but I already have a handful in the other hand, and as I crouch down, some of the other handful spills on my right side. Jesus! Jesus fucking Christ! Why can I not do this right? I stand up quickly and throw, this time some of the cremains sticking to my palm, which is now sweaty. Fuck! I try to kick the spilled cremains into the water, down below the rocks, through the crevices. What I need is a hose or something, but should I really be kicking my mother's ashes? I try to pick them up again. Too many, and then I crouch down again. Fuck, maybe this is illegal. I'd heard that this was not legal, that these cremains were not sanitary, that one needed permission or could only do it in the open sea. I turn around to see if anyone is here. No, no other cars. But someone's going to come here tomorrow and find them and then report it and connect it to me, because the funeral home guy, Chad, with his ham radio, will be listening to a police frequency. With the back of my hand, I brush the fallen grains into the crevices and am suddenly reminded of the way my mom cleared a fogged windshield. Quickly. Violently, almost, with the back of her hand, her rings clicking against the glass, as we drove through some or other sudden storm, all of us in the Pinto, on our way somewhere, the mall, the Cape, Florida, and for a second I wonder if her rings will be in the bag. Oh, shit. Her rings will be there, half-melted like a prize in a box of Cracker Jacks? No. Beth is the rings. Beth is the rings. Of course. How lame this is. How small. Terrible. Or maybe it is beautiful. I can't decide if what I am doing is beautiful and noble and right or small and disgusting. I want to be doing something beautiful, but am afraid that this is too small. Too small, that this gesture, this end is too small. Is this white trash? That's what it is? We were always so oddly white trashy for our town with our gruesome problems and our ugly used cars, our Pintos and Malibus and Camaros and our 70s wallpaper and plaid couches and acne and state schools. And now this tossing of cremains from a gold tin box into a lake? Oh, this is so plain, disgraceful, pathetic. Or beautiful and loving and glorious. Yes, beautiful and loving and glorious. But even if so, even if this is right and beautiful and she is tearing up while watching, so proud, like what she said to me when I carried her, when she had the nosebleed and I carried her and she said that she was proud of me, that she did not think I could do it, that I would be able to lift her, carry her to the car and from the car into the hospital. Those words run through my head every day, have run through every day since. She did not think I could do it, but of course I did it. I knew I would do it, and I know this. I know what I am doing now, that I am doing something both beautiful but gruesome because I am destroying its beauty by knowing that it might be beautiful. Know that if I know I am doing something beautiful, that it's no longer beautiful. I fear that even if it is beautiful in the abstract, that my doing it, knowing that it's beautiful and worse, knowing that I will very soon be documenting it, that in my pocket is a tape recorder brought for just that purpose,
that all this makes this act of potential beauty somehow gruesome.
I am a monster. My poor mother. She would do this without the thinking about thinking. Oh, fuck. I throw more. I do it as fast as possible. I crunch my hand into the bag and grab a handful of the tiny rocks. I pull it out and they spill from my grip. I pull my arm back and more tiny rocks trickle between my fingers, falling down between the huge white rocks under my feet. I throw. The pebbles spread out and dit-dit-dit-dit into the water. I consider specifics. Should I throw them all in one place or redirect the throws each time? Should I hold on to some for later to deposit elsewhere? Yeah, this seems like the best idea. I can hold on to some, half maybe, and throw the rest elsewhere. In Cape Cod, in Milton. I can spread parts all over the country, at all of her favorite places. I can spread them all over the world, the Atlantic, the Pacific. But then the airport, the plane, I'd have to carry them on the plane, would have to explain the box to the airport security people, and I have to put the box on that conveyor, and then... Do Cremaine show up in that radar machine they run your bags through? Maybe they'd ask me to open the box, demonstrate it like they do with laptops. Does it look like gunpowder? Maybe it does. I could check the Cremaines at the ticket counter. No, that would be bad. That would be worse. I grab again and throw. This is good. Good enough. No, this is great. This is best. This is where she spent her last years, by the water. I start throwing faster and faster, grabbing and throwing, flailing almost, dust everywhere. My coat is snowed with dust. She is aghast. I am pathetic. This is what I've done. This is what it's come to, winging her remains into the lake. No, she's not watching me. She's gone. She's an afterlife, but I will not, because I do not believe. I'll be exhausted by then anyway. I'm exhausted now. I am so tired. I'll jump in the lake, not to kill myself, but just to do it. The drama. I won't survive. If I took off my clothes, I'd make it. With the clothes on, I'd sink. My heart would seize up, and I'd sink. I could do something else, something dramatic. I'll drive the car into the lake with me in it, maybe with me not in it. I throw and throw into the gray. I know I will slip and fall into the lake and die. Oh, the irony! Just like that one woman who was throwing her mother's or her husband's ashes from a cliff, and a wave came over that cliff and took her too. Maybe it was a sister. No waves here. I will simply slip and dribble off into the lake. I have to shake out the bag, the last bits of the cremains. I should keep some. I could keep just a few bits as souvenirs. Souvenirs! What kind of asshole? What a fucking sick dickhead! Souvenirs? Thinking of souvenirs? I shake out the bag. I do not like to have to shake out the bag, like shaking a goldfish out of a baggie. Can the ashes swim? Do they dissolve? I am done, and sitting down, and my breath, quick and heavy, is visible because it's fucking cold all of a sudden with me not moving. The water undulates so slowly, it's hundreds of feet deep, and there are a million fish right there eating the ashes. There is no difference between the sky and the water, and I can feel the water rising around me, and I am already under the water, and all of the water is inside something larger, and I look at my feet to make sure they are secure, because I am inside something living. I drive to the church. It's only a few minutes from the beach, straight through the heart of town, past the library and the barber shop. I park and walk toward it, the air damp, cold. The door is open. It is about 11. I open it a crack and peek inside, sure that this must be a mistake, that this church cannot be open at this hour. Inside, all the lights are on, though dimly. I walk slowly inside. The church is empty. I stop in the glassed-in back area designed for latecomers, wailing babies. The church glows red. The nave is tall and white, and in the center is hung an almost life-sized Jesus, cast in gold, crucified, suspended by wire. So many times I had worried about the Jesus, that the wires would not hold, that it would fall, would land on the priests, the altar boys. I was much more comfortable when the priests were off to one side, during the reading of a psalm or liturgy. When one would stand in the center, right under, doing a consecration, lifting that chalice over his head, oh, that's when I was sure it would fall. It was just so precariously hung, just those two thin wires. This church is so small. I look out over the pews, and the church is tiny. The pews are so low, and there are so few rows. It was never so small before. I walk into the church's main chamber, up the center aisle, on the red carpet. I walk to the first pew, where I had sat the last time I was here. I had been in the front row and had been turning around beforehand, waving to a few people as they came in. I was sitting with Toph and Kirsten and Bill and Beth. We were huddled together in the pew, on its near end. We had been to the church, but had never sat so close to the stage before. My mother sat us in the middle or the back, and we were thankful, because then the priest in his coterie could not tell if we knew the words we were supposed to know.
I sat in the pew, holding Kirsten's hand, playing with toasts, dizzy, wearing my blue blazer, waiting for the service, all the glory. I'd known for months what it would be like. Had pictured it, the whole thing. There would be light. It would be day. There would be light through the high stained glass windows, prismatic. No, the light would be direct. Direct. Clear. Wide. Golden. The crowd would be endless. The church full like it is at Christmas, at Easter. The side aisles overflowing. The entire town there almost. All of the relatives, her brother and sisters from out east, the cousins, my father's enormous extended family from California, all her former students, all the other teachers, all my friends, Bill's, Beth's, high school, grade school, college, Toph's, their parents, the grocers, the doctors, nurses, strangers, admirers, everyone in their overcoats, their dark, deep colors, silent and reverent, the back entry area crammed, overflowing. Oh, but others would be outside the church, 100 on the steps, in the courtyard, wrapped around the building, down the street, 1,000 or so, waiting just to know that they were there, to validate, to help prove. In the church, the service would start, but priest after priest would stand and begin to speak, but then would be overcome and would have to give up, would shuffle to their red velvet chairs, yield the podium to the next, and then would weep, shaking, their faces resting in their long-fingered hands. We would be there, in the first pew, the beautiful and tragic Eggers children, soaked in blood, stoic, as 100 or more would stand before us and speak of her, all the gifts she granted them, and her life would be recounted in glorious detail, every moment, all the holding together and sacrificing, and then the ceiling would go. The barrel vaulting would rise, and the entire roof would quietly unhinge itself and lift up, would rise straight up and disappear, and the church's huge wooden cross supports would fly up and away, and would quickly get so small, tiny in the rich blue sky, and would become birds. The church would double in size, would triple, the space expanding, suddenly taking in all those waiting outside, and then become bigger, would take in everyone she had ever known, millions, all with their hearts in their two hands, offering them to her. The angels would come, thousands, slender, winged and bird-boned, descending and circling, all with sharp, small eyes, and they would be laughing, full of mirth. Why not? This was happy, happy. My mother would be there. No coffin, no remains, but her, ephemeral, huge. Her head as big as the nave, the angels moving around her, tiny by comparison. Her hair, her original hair, feathered up huge the way she liked it before she lost it, replaced by the darker, tighter curls. And her squinty smile, all the crinkles at the corners of her eyes, smiling to see us all there, knowing all those she had touched were there, that they were giving back, giving at least this much back. Oh, such a celebration! And we and she would all be so happy not to see her as some embalmed thing, some rubbery and gruesome thing, but instead as this wonderfully glowing, bright visage above us all. And she would be first smiling the big, closed-mouth smile she smiles, then that big, small-tooth smile she smiles. Then she would be laughing. Someone would say something funny, and she would laugh the way she laughed, silently, crazily, out of breath. It was so funny, whatever someone said. Who said that funny thing? Who? Maybe I said it. Maybe I said it. Maybe I said it made her laugh like sometimes we could, really bust her up so that it was just killing her, this laughing, her eyes struggling to stay open, to see, because when she laughed, my mom almost immediately teared up and had to wipe her tears with the side of her forefinger. Oh, that's when you knew you really had said something funny. When she would be crying, wiping her eyes, you had her then. You really wanted that. There was no greater thing, no achievement so great, so stirring. You tried to play a casual, deadpan, but you were so proud and thrilled watching her. You wanted her first to say, stop, stop, because you were so funny. But you would continue because you wanted her to laugh more, to really laugh until she would have to rest, to half collapse on the kitchen counter while you were sitting at the table after school. Oh, you're awful, she would say. Stop. Oh, but to see her laugh, you would say anything. And she so loved a good laugh at someone's expense. Bill's, Beth's, yours, her own. And at that moment, everything would be wiped away. All the times you feared her or wanted to run away or wondered how she lived with him, protected him. You wanted only her laughing like she did when she was on the phone with her friends. Yes, she would shriek. Yes, exactly. Then afterwards, she would sigh, breathing heavily, and say, oh, that's funny. God, that's funny. That's what she would say, and she would say something like that as the church walls disappeared, and
The nave evaporated and the angels flew faster, elliptically around her, and we would all be feeling vibrations from it all. Or they were all inside us, too, moving elliptically, or through our blood, and there would be music. ELO, maybe. Xanadu, maybe. Did she really like it, or just tolerate it for our sake? She would hum along a little, move her fingers back and forth a bit, and oh, we would have such a time. Then she would have to go. She would have to leave, but not before saying goodbye. See you, she would say, raising the last part, a high note, faux formality, and then turning from us to touch the small, golden cheek of that golden, broken, and crucified Jesus suspended in the air. The nave gone, but it still floating, the golden thing. She would touch it gently with the back of her tanned, ringed hand, that lucky bastard, and then she would be gone, and we would all collapse right there in the open church and sleep for weeks and weeks, dreaming of her. Oh, it would be something, something fitting, proportionate, appropriate, gorgeous, and lasting. I stand up and walk to the podium. It was 100 steps that day, but now, only 2. Then I had a piece of paper. I had brought it, the one from under the couch. I tried to recopy it onto a better sheet of paper, then ran out of time. And I put the piece of paper on the podium and looked up and over the... Where were the people? It was not a crowd. It was a scattered thing. A few here, a few there. Everyone loved her. Where were they? Everyone, of course, knew and loved my mother. Everyone, but where were they? This could not be. Would not do. A life, and then this 40 people. Where's the woman who cut her hair? Laura. Was she there? Is she here? All the volleyball women. Did they come? There's one, Candy, but where is her family? Where are her sisters? There's only Uncle Dan who has come, he says, to represent the family. And the cousins, her friends? There are some here, but my God, there were so many more. This is the crowd that was at my father's. It should not be the same crowd, the same number. They were not the same, these 2 lives. Where are the people from town? Where are the parents of her former students? Where are my friends? Where are the world's people to honor her passing? Was it too gruesome? Are we too vulgar? What is happening? All she put in, all she gave for you people, she gave everything for you people, and this is... She fought for so long for all you people. She fought every day. She fought everything, fought for every breath until the last, sucking everything she could out of the air in that brown living room, gasped again and again. It was unbelievable. Yes, she grabbed at the air, grabbed for us and for you. And where are you? Where are you, you motherfucking assholes?